Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Morelia Python Radio, brought to you by Morelia Python Forums, www.moreliapythons.com, the best forum for Morelia out there. In this episode tonight, we will be joined by Professor Richard Schein. He will be coming on just around 10. He has some stuff that he has to figure out, but don't worry. This will be one of those OT shows where you're going to have to listen back. But in the meantime, it's me and Owen. And we got Heather's going to be stopping by to talk about the Northwest Carpet Fest. But real quick, before we get up and going, a couple things. I want you guys to check out shipyourreptiles.com and the reptilereport.com. That's www.shipyourreptiles.com and www.thereptilereport.com. Also, if you're in the market for some cool reptiles, whatever it is, supplies, caging, et cetera, go over and check out the marketplace. That's something new that they got going up. It's www.themarketplace.thereptilereport.com. There's links over on our site, MoreliaPythonRadio.com. But, Owen, what's going on?
Yes.
Some cool things happening in the world of Morelia this week.
Tons of cool shit.
Yeah, that's exciting times, man. This is when doing morph stuff is kind of cool because...
because it's not cool. It's not cool any other time. It's only cool
when the
new shit's coming out of the egg. I want those people to say it. Admit it. It's okay.
No, it's cool to look at all the
time.
But,
I only do locality, but when the morphs hatch, I'm the first one to say that's a badass animal. But
yeah,
I only do pure Aryan Chaos talk as I swirl my brandy.
Wait a minute. But, you're not saying that's me, right? Mr. Frankensnake, come on. I have probably the
I have no comment on these allegations, sir, and I do not wish to further incriminate myself.
Yes. Good. This is one of those shows... This is one of those shows that I've been excited about for a long time. I'm actually a little nervous because to me it's like, reptile royalty maybe? Is that the way you put it?
not only reptile royalty, he's a very big name in the science community as well as the academics. So
yes.
We need to not sound like assholes this time.
Yeah, that's
hard. I want you to just be hovering over my mute button and just hit it every once in a while. I'll know what happened. God. We couldn't get more professional people to come in this episode. So,
yeah.
It'll be fine. It'll be all right. We've done worse. So, it's going to be a very cool episode. And on top of that, it's a bit, all this big crazy stuff is happening in the world of Morelia, which is just plain sick. It's just, oh my God, it's ridiculous.
Go ahead.
Albino granites hatched first, and I'm like, holy crap. And then the albino tiger, which we've only seen in the egg so far, and that is like the biggest cock tease you could ever do to me right now, is that you show me that thing, like his back in the egg, and I'm like, look at the albino tiger. That, no, you pulled his ass out of there. So...
Scoop it out, remix style.
Yeah, you ripped me. I don't care if he still thinks he's in the egg. You ripped me a better shot of him. So that's cool. The, what is it, the Zanic granite jag? Was that something that happened?
Yes.
Or was it the Zanic zebra jag? I don't know. I don't read. I just look at the pictures and go, holy crap.
It was the Zanic granite jag. Yep. Zebra jag was
Zanic here. Does that mean that there's exotic granites running around out there?
Yeah, that was last year too, I think. But he did, I think.
Damn it. I don't pay attention. So they look fantastic. And then Casper hatches out this clutch that I don't know what's in it. But all I know is that he has some crazy stuff in there.
The clutch
one looks
that
he like
just hatched out?
He hatched out two clutches, didn't he, this past week?
Well, the big one, the one that he was waiting for, and this is Casper from Singular Reptiles over there in Denmark, right? Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
And
he
hit the first ghost jag outside of Australia. Australia.
He's going to be sending it to his good buddy Owen free of charge. Go for it.
Yeah. I believe the one that he has pure coastals. I have that project, but what I have is at the moment I just have a caramel jag head exanic, but that's a IJ head exanic. You know, when you're crossing things, it doesn't really make a difference. And actually, the exanic IJ is stronger, I guess.
Yeah.
This is outcross. So, but anyway, it's cool stuff. Absolutely fabulous looking animal. I'm excited for him. I know he was counting the days down when they hatch. It's very similar to what I feel like with, although it's not a world's first, it's going to be so awesome when I hatch out something albino. God, I hope.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I hatch out all hets, I'll be so mad. And you'll laugh over at, you know.
I will not laugh to your face. I won't laugh to your face. Okay, that's the best I can do. So, okay, well, there's that. But, you know, it's always fun hatching something out. And, I mean, I hatched out my clutch of super caramels, and Casper and I went back and forth. He wanted to see pictures. He yelled at me for not taking good pictures. So, you know, it's one of those things where it's cool to share that with a friend, and to see them succeed and to see something just awestruck. That is a gorgeous animal, and can't wait to see it grow up. And then everybody else is doing well this year. I mean, I imagine we'll see some great stuff out of Paul. We're already seeing cool stuff out of Ollie. And then Todd. I mean, Todd right now is up to his neck in eggs, which eventually we'll make Todd up to his ears in babies. So we can only imagine what that's going to be. And it's not even including the cool clutches that just come out of left field. Like either a cool animal hatches out of either a weird animal hatches out of a normal clutch, or some people who just get lucky, like Ryan Young got lucky with the black-faced white lips to go. And that's another cool thing. And it's like, it's all going to start happening. It's all going to be cool. This is why I love baby season. The fact is that we're doing it now just tells you that we are so goddamn late in the season. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, it is June, and I still got mom's laying eggs right now.
Oh, okay. Did you happen to see the imbricata, the Morelia imbricata that I posted up today?
I did not see the Morelia Imbricata. Some of us
you
are not as hooked into the Imbricata as others. No.
No, you didn't see it? Oh, I'm going to
No, I missed it.
Hold on.
Go ahead.
On
a side note, another cool thing out there is Helen McCaffrey out in the U.K. She and I have been shooting back and forth on white lips. She got her gold phase white lips to breed. She got 11 eggs, and I'm insanely jealous of her and her white lip eggs. So good job. Keep it up, and email me back what you did so that I can do it. So
nice.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. Now, they're the harder ones to breed, or?
No, the blacks are harder to breed, but I didn't get anything this year. So at this point, I'm saying they're all kind of hard right now. So
you can't really.
IJs are the hardest thing on the planet. So.
All right, I'm sharing this over on our Facebook page. IJs.
Let's look at the Facebook page. We'll wait.
IJs are harder to breed than Alman Aaron.
Shut up.
So I really don't know too much of it. It's actually over on Australian Pythons Forum was where I found this. It's just a really cool-looking snake. It kind of looks jaggish, but it's pure imbricata.
Is this the thing you showed me with the reddish kind of head? No, that was something different.
No, that was something different. That was,
you send me these pictures of these carpet python, you're like, it's a this. And I go, it's pretty. I didn't hear you. I didn't hear what you said after that. So
yeah.
I figured it might have been one of those things. Because sometimes you're like, did I send you that picture? I go, no. And then you send it to me again. I'm like, oh, that's what that thing was.
Yeah,
holy,
that's one of the cool.
I did see that. I didn't know what it was.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there you go.
This is one of those times. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's an imbricata?
Yes.
It's like a jag on roids. What the fuck? Expletive deleted. Mute button, Eric. Right.
Yeah, it's cool stuff. We want to talk to Heather real quick.
I'm just going to stare at this while you talk to Heather. Go ahead. You don't
need
me. You got
to talk to us about the Northwest Carpet Fest. Hey, Heather, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good.
Doing well.
Good. Other than Owen is struggling with breeding IJs.
We're not talking about this.
Yeah,
we're not
going to breed IJs.
Room to talk. I have yet to produce any carpets yet. I'm still working on growing mine up, but hopefully next year I'll have a couple clutches.
Well, they're babies, so you have an excuse, so you're fine. Mine are adults, and one's a proven male. I'm just completely stupid. So
yeah. I have all the faith in the world that you're going to be able to produce IJs. Owen, on the
other hand. That's what I'm sending to the guy. You were talking to me. So, yep, all right, that was a nice stab to the heart.
It's all in love, Owen. You know this.
Uh-huh. Wound me.
So, you guys had an awesome Northeast Carpet Fest. It was a success again, as usual.
It was.
So we're gearing up
for...
Go ahead. So we're gearing up for ours. We're getting excited about it. It's going to be in Mill Creek, which is in the Seattle area, kind of in between Seattle and Everett, on Saturday, July 26th. Doug Taylor is hosting it this year. So...
Cool.
We're hoping that we can get some more out-of-towners to come in again this year and see how awesome the Northwest is.
I would. I still have it off on my calendar for work, and there's a possibility that I might be able to go. It's just plane ticket
airline
price.
Yeah.
That's why we're going to freight him to you. I'm going to drop him off at FedEx or Delta, and you're going to have to pick him up when he gets there.
Priority
okay?
Overnight at the FedEx hub, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to put a heat pack in with him. He'll be fine.
No, put a heat pack in, please. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely love to get out there on the West Coast anyway, let alone to go hang out with you guys for the Carpet Fest. That would be awesome. It's like killing two birds with one stone.
Yeah, there's going to be, as far as I know, Nick is still planning on being there. I haven't gotten a confirmation from Casey Lazick yet, But he was there last year. I know Justin's not going to be making it this year. Still trying to contact a couple of people who came last year from out of town to see if they're going to be making an appearance this year.
Cool. So what's on the menu for Nick to eat this year?
Yes, he's got to top the rat now. So are you guys just going to like find a squirrel?
That was totally unplanned. That was kind of a spur of the moment. He was talking about various foods that he's eaten that most people think are weird. And I don't know, was it Ryan Burke that spoke up and said something about, well, eat a rat? And everybody laughed, and I jokingly said, yeah, let's raise money for Rico, rats for Rico, and, you know, $5. And he's like, I'll do it. I was like, okay.
Oh, well, here we are.
So, yeah, I think we got like $75 together for him doing that. So who knows? You know, who knows what he's going to come up with this year, or if somebody else is going to come up and say, hey, I'm going to do this. So I guess
wow.
I have to show up and find out.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool. So
maybe
you guys...
like some slug eggs or something next year. So
slug omelets?
Yeah, slug omelets. Yeah, there we go.
I'd probably do that before a rat.
Yeah.
Even a cooked rat.
Yeah. Probably seasoned, I'd imagine. Just be all right. But...
Okay, Owen's down for that next year. No worries.
But I ain't doing it for $75. You better reach into them deep pockets and stop buying diamond pythons and fork over some money.
Yeah. What about you guys are doing an auction, correct?
Yes. Yeah, we're actually doing the same thing you guys did. I had talked to Howard about that earlier, that it kind of coincides with it's easier for the people who are traveling from out of town to bid on an animal per se from a breeder when they don't have to worry about shipping it back. Because one of our guys last year won one of the IJs. And it's not really a big deal, but they don't have to worry about that. They don't have to feel like they're putting somebody out by, you know, hanging onto this animal until you can ship and shipping it for them and whatnot. The vouchers, we decided to go ahead and go with the vouchers. And that will also give people a better choice to pick from. So instead, maybe they're not interested in this, you know, super caramel IJ or super caramel jag, and they want, you know, something else from this breeder, but not this particular animal. I think it'll boost interest in the auction. So,
yeah.
That was the thought behind that one.
Yeah, I like that idea. I'm not sure if I told you, but myself, E.B. Morelia, I'm putting $200 towards you guys for years.
Awesome.
Yeah,
yeah,
write me down. Write me down for the same. Yeah, do me for the same. Another 200.
Awesome. I'll be doing the same as well. 200 for mine, and mine doesn't expire. I listed it on the, and I'll list it again on ours. But I listed on yours that it doesn't expire because, you know, I don't have any Morelia clutches yet. But I do have corn snakes and geckos in case somebody's interested. But it applies to anything that I sell. That's the local, that also includes these tanks that I build. I plant them for geckos, and so it's just kind of a open-ended voucher for anything that Mystic Exotics has for sale, and it doesn't expire. So
cool. We'll probably do. I'm gonna come up with some type of swag type of item for from Morelia Python Radio too. I'll get with you. With the details with that, but. We'll hook you up.
Yeah, no, really looking forward to this event. I think it's going to be a lot of fun, and Doug Taylor's got some really cool animals that I'm really looking forward to seeing. Like, he's got a bull. And
oh, yeah?
That's, like, my number one. If I ever had the space and money, that's one snake I would get in a heartbeat.
Oh, but, heck yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen one in person?
No, I have not. I've just seen pictures, and I'm like, oh, I got one.
You're in for a treat.
I know. I'm super excited about seeing that. And hopefully Chris Koppel will be there from one of the Headhunter boys. I don't know if Bob Rindles will be able to attend or not, but Chris is planning on attending. So
awesome. That's cool.
Yeah. It'll be fun.
It's definitely it's a lot of work, but it's a good time. And
it is. It is a lot of work to organize it. You wouldn't think that it is, but there's a lot of behind the scenes stuff that has to take place. But you know, once the day finally gets there and everybody's there having fun, and it's all worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh. Although I don't remember the second half of the night.
No, you don't. How do you even remember how the crabs tasted? I mean, you ate them awful quick, and then you went spiraling downhill after that.
Yeah. Oh, and was that you that posted that picture of him? It says 10 beers in. He's got a pile of crabs in front of him.
No, I didn't. I didn't post that. My picture was him curled up sleeping in the car.
Yeah,
that was funny.
He locked himself in the car. Even in a drunken state, he knew that he should make sure that there was metal and glass separating me from him in the passed-out state. That was smart of him. I will give him props on that, because otherwise he would have woken up, I would have been several hundred miles away, and he would have been drawn on with a Sharpie. So.
Well, I heard somebody wanted to, tried to saran wrap Howard out of his car.
Eric into the car. That's what I wanted to do, because then I would have, you know, driven to the nearest Wawa and bought like the entire aisle of saran wrap. But you know, they started wrapping Howard's car, and I couldn't do that to Howard. He had opened his house to me. He had fed me. He had given me booze and steaks. So I couldn't go against Howard. But
yeah.
Eric, on the other hand, that's just fun.
Game on.
Yeah.
Well, I know I won't be passing out this year, so there'd be no Sharpies or saran wrapping me into my truck. So,
smart move.
Very good. Yeah, you got a little more tame there on the West, I guess.
Well, we don't have Howard and Julie over here.
I see. Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to keep up with them too. You know what I mean?
It is. They've got years and years of practice.
Also, it's not a sprint like you did. It's a long race, dude. You ran really fast right out the gate. Of course, you passed out.
Yeah, I did. You know, what was it? Well, I guess three months before that, I was on this really healthy kick, healthy eating, no drinking, none of that, and your rate of able to handle alcohol goes down real quick.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, real quick.
Yeah.
Is that what we're blaming it on? Okay.
All right.
No, Eric, I know.
That's the story, and we're sticking to it?
See,
so.
Owen, you're still young.
I did one of those AppleCare. What's that?
I was going to say, Owen, you're still young. You're still in your 20s, my friend.
Yes,
so like,
still a kid.
Yeah. You're in the 20s, there was no rest time. You know what I mean? Your tolerance never went up and down. It only went up.
Mm-hmm.
That just got to be the first time you've brought that into the conversation.
I did one of those AppleCare herbal cleanse things, and I tell you, after doing that, I tried drinking one glass of wine, and it felt like I drank the whole bottle.
Yeah.
So I know exactly. You clean your system, and you're used to eating healthy, and then all of a sudden you start drinking alcohol, and you're like, whoa, I should not be doing this right now.
Yeah. Your body's like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
But cool stuff.
No, I know what you're talking about.
And
we'll figure it out in about 10 years or so.
Yeah.
What are you at, Owen? What are you, 28? 28?
I'm going to be 28 on the 14th.
28. 28, okay.
Stop it.
Yeah,
it.
I know.
Stop it.
Watch how things change once you hit that magic 3-0.
You mean in 2 years?
Wasn't it Owen that said something about 10-year high school reunion or something?
Yeah, it was. I'm like, oh, my God, I graduated high school 10 years ago, and then all y'all jumped down my throat, and I'm like, well, I'm going to be quiet now. So.
Yeah, it's been 26 years since my high school graduation. Yikes.
No shit. I can't even count how long ago mine was. What the hell?
So, that's all right.
It's all good. So, okay, yeah. Awesome. So how can they get in touch with you, or do you get text coordinates of where the address is?
Well, they can contact myself or Doug Taylor for the address. And I can be reached on my email, mysticexotics@gmail.com. I also have the Northwest Carpet Fest page. I can be reached through there, or my Mystic Exotics page on Facebook. I can be reached through either of those.
Okay.
But we won't be advertising the address.
With
his caliber of animals, he didn't want it understandably publicized. So it's contact us for the location, and we'll go from there. And yeah. Oh, and as far as anybody that's coming in town, for people like you guys, you know, that are in the community, well known, we've got a number of people who can house you. So don't worry about hotels. I will be posting hotel information that's in the general area, either by the airport or close to where Doug's at. For those of us that, you know, might want to attend that we may not know well enough, but I just wanted to let you guys know that, you know, anybody that's you, Eric and Owen and Julie and Howard, we're gonna do what we can to get everybody, you know, set up in somebody's house rather than not have to, because the flight is going to be pretty expensive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. But now if you're out there on the West Coast and you didn't come out to the East Coast, here's your opportunity to here's your opportunity to go out and hang out with some carpet people. So, you know, a lot of people that were on the West Coast, they didn't get to the East Coast because, you know, they couldn't afford the flight. But, somebody's getting attacked by a dog.
Oh, you can hear that? I closed the door. That's my dog. Sorry.
No, her dog is attacking somebody. So,
she's just barking at somebody walking down the street.
Well, how dare they walk down the street? So.
So
if you're out west and your excuse was you couldn't make it out here, you have no excuse anymore. Go to that one. And so people down south need to watch out, because that's where we're putting our eye next. There's going to be one down there soon. So,
yeah, I have seen that there's been some people talking about it.
All you have to do is just slowly push those people, and they'll eventually do something. So the incentive is that I will send them Eric if they do it. So
ship your reptiles will cover the cost to
exactly. Shipping Eric. It'll be
great. You could use the BHOF 40% discount code, right?
Oh, my God. We get,
thank God.
What are we even doing here? I mean, jeez.
That's enough for you to go, too, Owen.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. If it's 40% off, I can come as well.
Yeah.
God, we'll need a bigger crate. We'll need separate crates. Just saying, I'm taller than you. So.
Very cool. So, awesome. So, yeah, I guess we'll probably have you on a couple more times as we get closer, so you can give us any updates or anything like that.
Absolutely.
Feel free to reach out. The platform is there for you. So.
Yeah, and definitely let us know how it goes when it's over, too.
Yeah.
We'll report.
Yeah.
Yep. There'll be some pictures posted.
I'll keep that show open the Tuesday after. So.
Okay.
Let us know.
Will do.
Cool stuff. All right. Well, appreciate it, Heather.
No problem. Great talking to you guys.
Likewise.
Okay. Thanks, Heather. Right.
See you.
Catch you later.
Cool, cool, cool. So now we're just waiting for to get the call in from Richard. And there we go. Owen,
that
I was going to say that, I got how are you making out with your babies? They feeding or what? Have you?
Yeah, I'm bringing most, if not all of them, to Hamburg on the 14th.
Ah, cool.
They're eating like hogs, so I'm going to bring them and see what they can do. So,
awesome.
And I also took pictures of all the babies, like every single one in the clutch, with this really nice camera, and I have them all in my computer, and I have not shared them with anybody because just haven't gotten there yet. So,
okay.
I know, I'm sorry. I'm probably going to take them. I'm going to take them to Hamburg. We're going to see what's up. So, people who are coming to Hamburg, that is when you can get your first look at the babies, and then when I get home from Hamburg is when I'll put them up on Rogue's Facebook page for sale. And then after a week, they'll go on King's Nick and Fauna. So if this is something you were kind of looking for, let me know. And we'll get you hooked up. They're all eating like monsters. This has been the fastest clutch I've ever seen take the food. And I have like 3 non-feeders. And everybody's just huge. They're all eating mouse fuzzies.
Okay.
So everybody came out big and healthy and nuts. I love it. I love it. Next clutch is going to be nothing but, like, you know, non-feeding pinky hamster eaters, and I'm going to want to die. So.
So you start your baby carpets with fuzzies then. Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. My fuzzies are actually kind of the ones I get for the baby carpets are a little bit smaller. I mean, it's an assorted bag, so you get smaller ones and you get larger ones and whatever, but.
I start mine on hoppers.
Oh.
That's so weird that you feed so, you know, like bigger meals as they're adults. Feed these big meals when they're young.
Yeah, poor little bastards. I mean, I start them on, they don't stay on the fuzzies for long when they get going. And
yeah.
they go up the hoppers quickly. But, I mean, and then once they're on the hoppers, the hopper mice, it's just a quick transition to pinky rats, and then they're done. They never see another mouse for the rest of their lives. So, yeah.
Yeah, I started feeding all of them shed out, so it's completely shed out. This is my poison ivy IJ clutch. And interestingly enough, there is one that stands out to me. It's a female, and she appears to be different than the rest. But, you know, I don't want to go posting pics until I'm at least like three sheds in to see.
Yeah, that's
what
my thing. I thought I picked my holdbacks, and then I took pictures, and I'm like, son of a bitch. And I don't know if I chose correctly yet. So when I say I'm going to be bringing them to Hamburg, I am. I'm just not going to be bringing the ones I'm keeping my eyeball on. So, you know. Or they'll be there, but they'll have ridiculous price tags on it because if you're going to spend that much, you can have it. But I'm hoping that you won't do it. So,
right. So I went to feed. I went to feed last night, and then when I was teasing them, you know, tease feeding them and trying to get them to strike and wrap, and you know, usually once you get that with carpets, then it's pretty much a done deal. IJ, sometimes they're a little bit pickier. They're a little bit finicky sometimes when they're first starting off. You know, they can skip meals and such. But anyway, I tried something different this time. I made it with like 2 of them, and I tried doing that, and I wasn't getting anything. They, you know, got tongue flicks and whatnot, but nothing from that. So I thought, you know what, let me just set the mouse in there or the hopper in there and you know, come back in the morning and see if anything took. Now, I didn't think that they would go, but sure enough, all but 2 fed. So
nice.
That was the easiest feeding experience I've ever had. You know, pretty simple.
I don't know. And you know what? I had the one clutch that I had was absolutely terrible. Was the one that hatched in September. They just didn't take because I'm thinking that they. You know, we always talk about how these things know what's going on outside, and they all hatched, and it started getting colder, and it started getting into October, and it was like, oh, my God. So they just didn't want to feed for me. So
Right.
It's one of those things where if you can get them into the early summer and just let them ride that wave of the summer weather and get them feeding and done before you can get it over with, it's good. So.
Right. Yeah, I had a few holdouts from the previous years that really didn't take that well to feeding, but you know, just persistence, patience, I guess, is the most important thing. And sure enough, they're going good now. You know, it's a little behind as far as you know, where I'd like them to be size wise, but you know, at least they're eating and feeding good. So that's,
yeah, as long as they're eating, you can always fix it. And you know, when it comes to other things, you know, as long as they're eating, you can always fix it. If they're not eating, that's where shit gets difficult. So, you know, like I have one baby left. I have one of the babies left over from last year. Is a super caramel female that would not take the food. And right now, she, you know, about late last year, she started actually eating on her own and eating properly. She's about the same size as some of her half-siblings from 14. So,
okay.
And she's actually eating the same amount of food that they are, the same size. And she's finally starting to put on weight and size. So it's almost like she's growing with the year behind. But who cares, because she's putting on the weight, she's getting the size, and, you know, she might be small for her age, but as long as she's eating, I don't care what's happening. So,
right,
take all the time you want to grow.
Absolutely. So, I'm trying to think. We got some pretty cool questions coming in from the audience about for Richard.
Yes.
Basically, what we're going to hit on is in the episode is thermoregulation. That was one of the – he has a paper that he authored with Tom Madsen.
Mm-hmm.
And in the paper, he wrote about thermoregulation of water pythons. That because of where they're from, that you would think that that's the most important thing. Was relatively unimportant in the day-to-day life of water pythons was thermoregulation. So I want him to go into a little detail as far as that goes. And it's one of those things that, you know, people often discuss, and, you know, it's something that I don't know if we really, as keepers, know the science behind it. You know, I think some people kind of go with what works for them, and that's kind of cool. But I think it would be cool to hear it from a science perspective, you know, somebody that's done the studies on the animals in the field. I'm curious to see how that relates to, you know, like imbricata or a diamond python. You know, something that's more temperate reptile. And what's their different, you know, different activities as far as thermoregulation goes. I know you wanted to talk to him about water pythons in general, or liasis in general. Some natural history we'll hit on. I wanted to throw in there some natural history on Morelia imbricata, because he has several papers that he's written on Morelia imbricata. And just to throw it out there real quick, one of the tools that I use as far as looking up these papers and such, Google Scholar. You can go to Google Scholar. You can either type in pythons, Australian pythons. I'm sure you can even type in his name and his papers will come up. But there's a lot of good info on there, and you know, some really cool stuff. I wanted to talk to him about that, and see, you know, what he has to say about that as far as their natural history and such. We got a good question from Dave Kelly, wants to know about diamond python nests. You know, the construction and where they're located, and you know, are they dry, or when they're going to lay eggs, are they seeking out moisture? And then we're going to talk a little bit about the evolutionary history and diversification of pythons in Australia, and see what his thoughts on that as far as, you know, recently they moved. There was that paper that came out. I was talking to Dave about this today. He sent it over to me. Had it from a while back. But, you know, they moved, I guess when I was so overwhelmed by the whole thing of scrubs being moved out of Morelia that I kind of didn't catch on to the other things that happened. So Leo Python is gone. That's
yes, it is. I knew this.
Yeah, well, I guess because you keep...
I needed to know this. Yes,
yeah.
And, they moved... it's now in...
It's in with ring pipe.
Petrophagus, I should know this or how to pronounce it. Chris is, if he is listening, just probably smashed his head against whatever desk is near him because of my pronunciation of that, and I apologize for that, and please don't text me angry words. So
nice.
So yeah, that they're in there now, because it's now Petrophagus, or whatever it is, Albertese for the golds, and Horsa for the blacks. And
now,
that's where we're at right now.
Is there different subspecies of those? Because
there
when
are several.
Okay.
Because if you look at another paper, they've busted down a few different locales, but the problem is that the ones they were looking at are all specimens in jars, and I don't know if they've actually actively found living specimens of these or not, but I want the quote-unquote Bennett's white lip because they're the red ones, so no one knows really. There are rumors flying around that they've been collected and that they're eventually going to make their way into the United States, and that they are like the gold-faced white lips, but instead of gold on the side, they have red. And the first person to tell us this was somebody told us this on the show, you and I, about the red-faced white lips, and I started doing the research. And there's a few other different island locales of gold-faced white lip, which is, they have varying degrees of gold. The head shape's a little different, but again, this is all either specimens in jars or specimens from a while ago that were written down in journals. So I don't know if there's any alive. If they are, they could be being confused for other just ugly gold-faced white lips. No one knows. So I would like to see those to be further built in. And if there are red-faced white lips out there, I will find them.
Okay. So I got the pronunciation from Dave. He smashed his computer and
excellent. See,
yeah, it's
now the problem is that I'm actually in Ohio for business. So if Dave Kelly does want to come and attempt to kick my ass over my pronunciation, he probably could if he can find me before I leave. So
he's just hooking a brother up, you know what I mean? But anyway, hopefully I don't butcher this. It's Bothrochilas.
Bothrochilas. See, I'm going to forget this next time and call him Bothrochilas or something like that and really piss him off. So, sorry, Dave, but thank you for the information.
Yeah. The dude's like a walking reptile encyclopedia, man.
So, yeah, they moved the white lips into that, and then they also moved Timor and Retic are now together in a group. I believe it's called Maleo Python.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the thing that I was kind of taken back by is, one, that they didn't move chondros to separate.
And you know what else they didn't move?
And what?
Ruffies. They're still in Morelia.
Well, no, I don't necessarily think that they should be moved out of Morelia, per se.
I thought
chondros were definitely seen as two different species. I thought that was pretty much...
I think chondros and rough scales should be removed from Morelia, called Viridis, and have, and then I know Dave Natouche was talking about splitting chondro up. So I believe that maybe some further research will eventually reveal that, because they took Owen Pelly away. And, you know, you look at an Owen Pelly python, yes, it's got the body of a scrub, but it's got the head of a carpet python. So, you know, you can make that, you can say that that needed to be removed, but...
Well, I guess the other thing that kind of I was taken back by was the fact that, and Dave was telling me that they didn't really compare the, they didn't really break down the carpets as subspecies-wise, but basically they have two. They have Morelia spilota and
yep.
Morelia spilota variegata. So it's kind of
yep.
like there's diamonds and then there's Darwins and everything is lumped in. And, of course, Morelia bredli, that's separate. And that's been separate. And then there's Morelia imbricata. Well, actually, imbricata isn't on this sheet. So that's kind of weird.
Yeah, so I think the paper was done very well. Of course, there's always room for improvement, and there's always something else that needs to get done. And I think the next thing would be to venture into deeper into Morelia and see what can be separated, whether green tree and rough scale need to come out onto their own. And the thing is, they're not just the way that we all imagine they're doing it. They're not. There is a man out there that we all know who will just decide some things, write it in a paper, and decide that's good enough, and then basically dare the scientific community to prove him wrong. I'm not going to mention that person's name because that would be counterproductive. What this paper is actually doing is they did DNA research to find out which animals were related to each other just more closely than others. The only problem is that they didn't really take – there's no set measure on what is a separate species or subspecies. It's all just kind of like what the scientist who wrote the paper believes is the correct percentage. And unfortunately, that kind of just makes for a lot of confusion. So it would be nice to have a set standard on what is a separate species or subspecies. The problem is that then you would have to get all the members of the scientific community to agree. Good luck with that. So I don't think we're done. I do think it took a very nice big step in the right direction to get all the taxonomy finished, but I wouldn't be surprised if you saw more splits in maybe not in the ones that have already been split out, but maybe in the bigger groups like Morelia, and then eventually they're going to taper off onto different species. I know speaking with the monitor breeders, Varanus albicularis, which is the black throat, contains black throat, white throat, Microstictus black throat. They're all albicularis, so it's kind of hard to figure out which one's which, and there's a big debate whether you can split that into four or five different complete species. So it's not just us, but yeah, things are definitely going to be, we're not done shaking it up. Are you still there? Did I hear you?
Yes. Yeah. No, you're right. I'm keep going for a second. I'm doing something.
Keep doing what you're doing. I don't look at me. All right, well.
I'm talking to Richard. Go ahead.
Okay, you go talk to Richard. I'll just keep ranting. It's cool. I got stuff to talk about now. And so... it would be very nice to get this all finished and done, but taxonomy is one of those things that's always shifting and always changing, so we kind of just got to roll with the punches. Whether or not you can accept the science, I mean, it's kind of funny when I was doing my iHerb stuff and I went to put in the all the scrub pythons under Semolina, and it wasn't an option. And now there were the island localities of the scrub python, so it's like, okay, everything's a kinghorn eye. Even though it can't possibly be a kinghorn eye, but kind of one of those things. So if people say that the rough scale and the chondrus are that closely related, I would not be surprised if they were to spin off out of Morelia again into their own thing, almost like a cousin species. So, and it's kind of cool because I, just by mere looks alone, I would have figured the Panon, Timor pythons would be somewhere in Lyasis because they look like an angry Macaulay python to me, but they went off and they're off of the retic, and they're the only two species in Malayo python, so who knows? Maybe they'll add some more there. They'll split some things off. They'll decide everything needs to come right back in. It's one of those things where as technology and science grows, we can have to change our opinion to shit. So that is all I can rant about.
Yeah, that's good.
Good? Did I do good?
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, Richards is he's going to be calling in a few. We're just I guess he's not on Facebook, so the only way that I can talk to him is through email. So that's why it's a little more difficult. But anyway, I want to clear something up. I guess back a couple minutes ago, I said something about diamond pythons and Darwin's, but I don't really know what I said, but I said that I was talking to Dave, and he just meant that they compared a diamond and Darwin. So that's what he meant by that. But anyway, while we're sitting here waiting for him to come on, what are your thoughts on just like everybody using scientific names as opposed to common names? Where do you think? You think that's the hot? Because it seems like, is it something that's getting lost? You know, is it something
I was using the Latin before it was cool, and that is exactly how I feel about this crap. So, if you're one of those people that says, oh, you can only refer to it in the Latin, shut up. It's shut up. We're not in the laboratory. We're not in the field. Just because you can say it in Latin and refer to it in Latin and pronounce it in Latin doesn't mean you have to flaunt that fact around to everybody else who might be getting started, who might be just understanding it, who hasn't had a scientific background, just in it because they like the snakes. Shut up, okay? If you know the Latin, that's good. You shouldn't have to refer to it no matter what. God, reptile
but don't
history. Like, Jesus.
Do you think that, though, by not doing that, that will be something that gets lost?
No. Why? It's in textbooks. It's on the internet. This is the world we live in is where pictures that you put on the internet never go away. So why did all of a sudden something that's been documented for hundreds of years since some guy did a charcoal drawing of it and named it, is it going to suddenly disappear? Your argument is invalid here. Shut the fuck up.
I think it's kind of one of those things like, I think of codominant and the way that the reptile herpetoculture uses that, which is wrong.
But here's the thing, if you don't understand, ask a question and someone should explain it to you. Now, if the guy who's explaining it to you is a dumbass, it's one of those things that you should probably ask other people. Yes, the phrase codominant is probably used incorrectly. Just how the phrase hypo-red is not true in carpet python. It's one of those things that you got to wade through the bullshit, but don't add to it by saying that only I shall refer to animals by their scientific names, because all you're doing is trying to make yourself feel smarter and act smarter around people who might not understand you. And that's when I'm going to smack you in the face if you come up to my table. So,
so you have a policy that if they...
Horse, I went to college for science too, all right? Shut up.
How do you really feel about this, Owen?
You pissed me off. I'm going to flip something in my very
in
nice
hotel
right now.
Well, I mean, I guess the thing of it is, though, is like again, you take something like codominant, right, which is incorrectly used. So when you're talking on a level, like all of a sudden, if you get on a level to where you want something to be, I had this problem in real life because what happened is, one of my assistant managers that used to work for me, he went to school for biochemistry. Yes, he went to school for biochemistry, and he was a manager in a supermarket. So let that be a lesson to you all. Anyway.
Ouch. Don't follow your dreams. Get a job.
Well, he's a pretty freaking smart guy. Anyway, you know, we were talking about because he's big time into genetics. So I kept talking to him about codominant, you know, because I figured, there's my chance to talk to somebody that's knows a thing or two about genetics on for real. You know, it's not like we're just breeding a couple snakes and this is what's going on. And sure enough, he had no clue to what I was talking. He's like, nah, it doesn't work like that. What do you mean? And, you know, it just, if you're going to have a conversation, I don't know. I think it should be right. I'm not saying that I kind of agree with you to a certain extent that, you know, you don't have to know Latin names or, you know, that kind of stuff. But then I don't think that you should be speaking about it. Does that make sense? Like, I don't think that you should go around and say to people.
And here's the other thing. If you are interested, if you want to know, last time I checked, the library and the internet did not have locks on where they kept the genetics books. You are well within your right, and you are encouraged by me, a voice coming out of your computer or phone who is telling you it's okay to learn about genetics on your own. It's all right. You can do that. Go get a book and read it. It's fine. So if you don't feel like anybody knows what they're talking about, or if you feel like you're not getting all the information, go get it. And then impart that knowledge, but don't be a dick about it. That's all I'm saying. So we're not going to lose the Latin. We're not going to lose the scientific names. We're not going to lose taxonomy and nomenclature. Are you serious?
But don't you feel that dumbs down the herp community more than they're already dumbed down?
No.
No, you don't think so?
If you want to know, here's the thing. If you want to learn about an animal, first thing you're going to learn is the common name. If I'm walking around with somebody and they don't know an animal, am I going to sit there and scream and tell them what the Latin is? They're not going to give a shit. You're going to learn the common name. You're going to figure out what it is, what it does, what it eats, where it's from. Then you're going to start diving deeper. As you dive deeper, the first thing you learn is the Latin. Who discovered it? All these other things about it. But if you just sit there and go, I'll only refer to it as the Latin because I fear that we'll lose it and we'll dumb down the herb community, you're just you're just looking for an excuse at this point to show off, in my opinion. It's
okay.
Good for you for knowing the Latin, and good for you for having that knowledge. But you don't need to sit there and say that everybody should refer to it in the Latin. And I know there are some classifieds who say they don't want anything listed unless it's in the Latin. And that's fine when it comes to some of those smaller species and for those people who really need to know that nomenclature for breeding things, because there could be different subspecies and different here and different that. But just to say that you need to have it to weed out the dumb people is just, you know, you want to make it sound like hoity-toity jackasses? Congratulations, you're doing a bangarang job. So, I'm done now. You pissed me off. I'm going to hang up now.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean
no,
to piss
not.
You off.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm trying to figure something else. So, you want to rant a little more?
No, I'm
Hold
tired.
On.
I don't want to talk anymore.
Kind of have to.
See, you must have a list of things that you know will piss me off when you need a rant, because then just say it. It's like, oh, and how do you feel about this? And then you just watch me go. It's not fair, dude.
You do it to me all the time. All right,
I know I do, but it's easier with you, and I just can't. People forgive you more than they forgive me. I mean, I'm probably going to hear about this stuff later, about, you know, the fact that I'm a jerk and totally taking a crap on how the intelligent people don't get to do their things. So, Yep.
Don't say that one.
You know, that's what?
No, go ahead. Go ahead. I gotta try to call him through Skype. So.
Oh well, you go ahead. You should have done that before I'm starting to calm down. See, now it's lowering, so you need to raise it back up now. You know, it's just one of those things. Nomenclature is somewhat stupid. It's always changing, it's always different, and it's always hard to figure out what's going on with it. So the fact you have to sit there and refer to the animals only by their Latin is correct until it changes, and then now you have something to one-up on everybody else. So, you know, trying to be on top of the hill is fine, but don't be a jerk about it. I mean, I know people who wrote papers on animals that they studied their entire lives and still refer to them as the common name or whatever else it is. I know people who are just hard tacked on the taxonomy, but somehow find some of the nicknames that the animals are given to be funny, and that's all they refer to them as. Also, if you watch all the people who are if you watch any documentary where they're trying to teach you, they don't sit there and talk down to you and talk to you in the Latin form or the scientific form as much as humanly possible, because that's not what they're there for. They're here to educate you. If you signed up for a class on the species to be taught by a well-renowned college professor, they may only refer to it in the Latin because they want you to learn the Latin. They're not doing it just because they know it and they want to show it. And that's partially where I think a lot of these people are coming from. And that's, it is what it is. And when it comes to the biology and the behavior of the animal coming through nomenclature, that doesn't mean squat. It really doesn't, because the nomenclature is, half the time the nomenclature is what somebody first perceived it as and thought about it was. And sometimes the nomenclature is so stupid and way off when it comes to those animals, it's changed anyway. And
okay. We have – I got it. We got them.
Thank God. Can I stop talking now?
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
I'm gonna hang up now and just take a nap. I'll call you in 20 minutes.
Yes, yes. Hey, Richard, is that you?
Hello.
Hey, how you doing? Welcome to Morelia Python Radio. We're honored to speak to you, and glad you could join us.
I'm pleased to be talking to you too, Eric.
Yeah, and that's Owen there in the background.
Yes, yes, still here.
Okay. So, yeah, go ahead, Owen. You start.
Richard, why don't you just start off in telling us a little bit of background about yourself, some of the work that you're doing, and some of the reptiles you've been working with.
Sure. So I'm an Australian, born and bred, and was one of these obnoxious little children that was always in love with snakes and lizards and so forth from an early age. And somehow or other, I managed to turn that into a career. So I'm a professor in biology at the University of Sydney. And for, longer than I care to think about, probably 30-odd years, I've been conducting research on the ecology and evolutionary biology of reptiles and amphibians in Australia. And pythons, which I guess are the primary interest for you guys, have always been a part of my life and a large part of my professional career.
Awesome. So what are some of the species that you're currently working with?
Look, it comes and goes a bit. You know, the early days, based in Sydney, diamond pythons, Morelia spilota, were, you know, that's the local snake. That's the one you get out in the suburbs. And there were a lot of concerns that they were endangered, and particularly that they were endangered by people catching them and wanting to keep them as pets. And so Dave Slip, my first graduate student, put radio transmitters in diamond pythons in the suburbs, and we discovered that they were actually much more common than anybody thought. And we found out lots of fun things about their biology. They were the first pythons that had been radio tracked, really. we did a lot with carpet pythons, coastal carpets, and then later with Dave Pearson, we looked at the Western Australian carpet pythons, Morelia spilata imbricata, a very different kind of an animal. But the probably the biggest python project I've done has been water pythons up at Fog Dam in the Northern Territory. That's been going since about 1985, still going. Thomas
wow.
Madsen has worked with me for a long time. We've got, well, over the years, we've individually marked probably something like 10,000 water pythons. We've radio-tracked them. We've done all kinds of studies on them, really just trying to understand the day-to-day life of a python out there. What are the challenges that it faces? How does it overcome those? And in the process, we've learned quite a bit about the functioning of these sort of tropical ecosystems, because the pythons are really significant predators in these places.
Very cool. So, yeah, as far as your one of your papers that I was reading with thermoregulation with that you did with water pythons, and how it was relatively unimportant in their day-to-day life of a water python as far as thermoregulation. Can you explain, like, can you go a little in-depth on that?
Sure. That was the paper was written partly as somewhat tongue-in-cheek, in that there's a very long tradition in the scientific study of reptiles of looking at their thermal biology. And the paradigm is that, you know, the little lizard that comes out from its coal burrow and it sits in the sun and it gets nice and warm and then it runs around at a constant body temperature all day. And it's really important that it can get access to the right temperatures and so on. And that's absolutely true. I mean, that's the way the world works if you're a small lizard living in a cold climate and you're active during the day. But where we work up near Darwin in tropical Australia, it's stinking hot. It's 30-odd degrees centigrade every day of the year, and there's absolutely no problem getting warm enough. The problem is that if you stay out in the sun, you're going to cook, and you'll be killed. So, in fact, most of the reptiles up there come out at night. And if you start looking at the role of temperature for an animal like that, the only real problem is avoiding getting too hot. You're never going to be too cold. Because it just doesn't get cold there. So the snakes don't really spend too much effort worrying about getting warm. They do come out and bask a little bit. Females, just before they're going to lay their eggs, will come out and sit in the sun and get quite warm. They're very particular about where they lay their eggs. The eggs have to be kept nice and warm, and there's a limited number of places that can provide that. But really, when you got right down to it, if you're a water snake living in tropical Australia, the last thing you're worrying about is how to get warm. You're spending most of your time worrying about how to keep cool.
Cool.
Very cool. So how does that, you know, like, is when it comes to diamond pythons, you're seeing the total opposite because of the cooler environment?
Yeah, look, absolutely. And I think at least historically, most of the pet keepers used to keep diamonds too hot. You know, Sydney's quite a temperate climate. Our winters are cool, not by comparison with Kansas or something, but, you know, you still might be comfortable walking around in a T-shirt and shorts on a nice warm day in winter, but it's still, you know, probably, you know, 10, 15 degrees at night. And so, yeah, look, the diamond pythons are pretty much obsessed with finding a nice sunny patch, especially during the cooler months of the year. They will be active virtually year-round, but during winter that mostly just consists of crawling out from a rock crevice and sitting in the sun for an hour or two and then going back in again. They don't do very much. And for them, it really is critical. So they seem to put a lot of effort into trying to get nice and warm in the afternoon, and then they form a nice tight coil beside a mammal path, the sort of place that brush-tailed possums might come along. And because they're coiled up tightly and they got nice and warm just before dark, then they can stay warm for a few hours, and that means they're warm enough to detect a nice furry meal coming towards them. They're warm enough to catch it and overpower it. And so, you know, temperature is a big deal if you're a diamond python. If you're a Western Australian carpet python living near Perth, it's miserably cold. part of the year, and you spend a fair bit of time sitting out there and basking. But as you move up into the Australian tropics, you really don't have to bask very often.
Great. Okay. So there was a question that we had in from one of the from one of our listeners, and it was about diamond pythons. And Dave Kelly wants to know about diamond python nests. Could you talk about maybe their construction of them? Where are they located? Are diamonds seeking out dry areas, or are they seeking out more moist areas to lay their eggs?
Yeah, we had a few of the females that Dave was following around with transmitters did go ahead and reproduce, and they built these rather nice nests. They were pretty subtle. Usually they'd find a place where there was a fair bit of leaf litter around, and they'd just sort of crawl in underneath it and curl up, and that would sort of push the leaf litter up, so you had, looked like a football sitting under this quite dense leaf litter with just a single entrance hole coming out. I don't know that they were particularly dry or moist places. Somewhere in the middle, I would guess. The females would come out and bask quite frequently to top up their temperature, and then they'd come back in there, and of course that would warm up the eggs. But they were also very good at the shivering thermogenesis, so that as long as the temperature was fairly close to what they wanted, they would show this rapid muscular twitching, which would be enough to elevate the temperature of the eggs quite considerably. I remember one female that nested in quite a damp spot in a damp year, and she actually abandoned her nest just before the eggs were within about a week of the eggs being due to hatch. But I think it was just costing her too much, and she'd sort of reached that decision that motherhood wasn't all it was cracked up to be, and she decided to leave. And we took those eggs out and we incubated them, and most of them hatched. But I think she just picked a colder spot, a damper spot than she should have. And presumably they sometimes make mistakes like that.
Huh. Interesting.
Right. Now, is the color of the diamond python, the fact that they are so dark, just so they can – I know you said it was kind of moderate temp in Sydney. Do you believe it's so they can – warm up as quick as possible and go back, kind of like how they believe Bullen's pythons just come out of the jungle, warm up on the rocks, and then go back in the kind of coldish jungle?
Yeah, look, I can easily believe it. I mean, Morelia spilota is very, very widespread, and the diamonds are certainly in one of the cooler parts of the range. I think it's quite striking that the juvenile diamonds are of course, coloured like carpet snakes from further north, so that you've had the evolution of this dark coloration in the older animals, but it doesn't turn up in the juveniles. And from what we know about thermal biology, being black really only helps if you're quite large. So it may well be that's really a large part of it. On the other hand, it's always been very striking to me how similar the coloration is of a diamond python to some other unrelated snakes from different families that are found in other parts of the world. The broad-headed snake, Hoplocephalus bungaroides, a venomous and a lapid that's found in the Sydney region, is a hell of a lot smaller than a diamond python, but really that black background with the yellow flecks, there's a bunch of vipers that do the same, so... You know, it's a pretty effective camouflage. If you are looking for a radio track diamond python and you've got the signals, roaring in, and you know the rotten thing is within a meter of you, it's remarkable how long it can take you to actually spot that snake. And of course, carpet snakes are also pretty hard to see. In general, snakes are very good at hiding. But I suspect that there's a thermal advantage to it. Whether that's what's driven the evolution of that dark colour, I think that's the most likely explanation, but I wouldn't claim that we can nail it down.
Okay.
I have another question that came in about maternal behaviour in pythons. Do you think that it's ancestral or independently derived in these lineages as far as diamond pythons?
Oh, boy, It's very widespread. It does seem as if there's a fair bit of variation out there in terms of whether or not the female contributes heat to the eggs or whether she just curls around the eggs and essentially forms a very tight package which prevents moisture from being lost. And I think the evidence is fairly clear that some of these smaller pythons, like the children's pythons and so on, that really the big function of maternal brooding is to keep the eggs from losing too much water. Once you've got that in place and you've got a very powerful creature like a large python with lots of muscles, then shivering thermogenesis becomes an option. So my guess would be that perhaps maternal attendance of the eggs and protecting them against drying out may well be ancestral in pythons, but this ability to shiver and keep the eggs warm may well have either cropped up independently or been lost independently in different kinds of lineages. But I think you could probably find some people like Dale Donato and Olivia Lorday who've actually worked on those sorts of questions that would give you a far more sensible answer than I could.
Okay. Interesting. Now, as far as have you done any work with figuring out the actual temperature of the eggs during incubation? Does it spike? Are you seeing temperatures stay pretty consistent?
Yeah, in general, what's impressed me has been the consistency of the temperatures. Pythons seem to like to lay their eggs in places where the temperature is relatively stable, and the species that are capable of shivering obviously can keep that going. Now, having said that, if the temperature drops too low, the female will decide it's just too much effort and she'll stop, and so the egg temperature will drop down. There's an interesting situation with the water pythons up in the Northern Territory. We discovered that, and when I say we, Thomas Madsen really is the guy that did all the hard work. There's two different types of places that water pythons lay their eggs. One of them is sort of in burrows that go down under the roots of some of the trees by the edge of the floodplain. And the other one is in the burrows that the big monitor lizards, the goannas, dig. And it turned out that if you lay your eggs down under the tree roots, you've got to stay around and you've got to shiver because it gets a little bit too cool down there and the eggs do better if they're kept warm. We did some laboratory experiments where we kept some eggs at variable temperatures and some at constant temperatures, and there was a big benefit to the baby pythons that came out if you kept them at constant temperatures. But if you laid your eggs in a goanna burrow, they stayed pretty warm anyway. The goannas dig their burrows in places with a lot of sun exposure. And so the females there didn't even hang around. They stayed for a few days and then they left. And those females were very likely to survive and they could breed again the next year. Whereas the females that laid their eggs down in the burrows systems under the roots of the trees, they had to shiver, they lost a lot of energy, they were very thin and looked miserable by the time they finished. Quite often they'd be killed by predators. If they did survive, it took them a couple of years before they got enough energy accumulated to lay another clutch. So that you've got a very different kind of flexible life history in these things. You've got some girls that laid their eggs in hot nests and could then romp off and have a good time, not worry about the eggs and breed again next year, and others that were putting a lot of effort into motherhood, but as a result were in some trouble themselves and were very unlikely to breed again until a couple of years later. We actually had a couple of cases where burrows were destroyed by people bulldozing them, and the females would go off and use the other kind of nest quite easily. So it's just facultative, it's just flexible. It's not like there's two genetic types of females. It just depends where you lay your eggs as to how good a mother you've got to be.
Huh. Wow.
So you didn't see any correlation with babies that were hatched in a burrow wanting to find a burrow when they themselves became breeding age?
No, but we don't really have data. I mean,
if a burrow was there, great. If not, pretty. Okay.
That seems to be the case. I mean, we couldn't actually get the babies out. You know, we've done some more recent stuff with them in a bit more detail, but it's pretty hard. You know that there's some eggs down there, but without disturbing the system, it's hard to get your hands on them. We do know for the keelback snakes, it's a little thing closely related to the American water snakes, but it's an egg layer, and it occurs at Fog Dam as well. We know that the place that you are laid as an egg is the place that you'll return to lay your own eggs. We've got a lot of data now from Greg Brown's work. Greg goes, he walks up and down the dam wall every night, picks up the snakes. If they're gravid, he keeps them. They lay their eggs in captivity. We incubate them. We release the babies after we mark them. And we can pretty much guarantee that a female keelback, they mature in about a year or so, she will come back and lay her eggs at exactly the place that the egg that she came out of was laid in. And in a few cases, we actually accidentally released the babies at the wrong spot, and they went back to those spots where we released them. So they're small snakes. They must have a brain the size of a pea, but somehow or other they remember the exact place that they were released as babies immediately after they hatched. And when it comes time to lay their own eggs a year later, they can go back and find that spot and lay their eggs there. It's amazing.
What's their natural range? How far do they normally go out of? I mean, when you release them, how far do they leave? Do they kind of go way out there, or do they generally stay around?
Well, no, they move around a fair bit. I mean, the water snakes sort of follow the edge of the water. It's very seasonal there. It's hot all year, but the monsoonal rains, sort of December through March, turn the whole thing into a huge floodplain with water everywhere, and the snakes move out looking for frogs. And then as the water dries up again, they follow the edges of it, so that they move many, many kilometres.
Wow.
The water pythons do a seasonal migration following the rats. As the wet season floods the lower areas, the rats are pushed up into higher, drier ground at a few kilometres away, and most of the water pythons on Fog Dam follow them. And they live out there in the flooded areas for a few months, eating the rats and eating the eggs of magpie geese before they come back down to the dam wall in the dry season where the water stays during the dry.
Wow. So even through coastal flooding, even through flooding and going kilometers at the kilometers, they still end up back in the same spot. That's amazing.
They've got an amazing ability to find specific places. If you radio track a python, and this is true of every species we've looked at, you'll find it, you know, under a particular clump of grass one day, and it doesn't look any different from every other clump of grass. But if you keep tracking that snake for a year or two, there's a good chance it'll come back and sit under that same clump of grass sometime a year later. And in the case of the water pythons, you know, this can be after the wet season floods have had the entire area in between underwater for months. There can't be any scent trails left, but these things will suddenly pop up one day and head straight across directly to the exact place that you found them last year. So they know their way around. They know exactly where they're living, and we don't know how they do it, but it's pretty impressive.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I saw some stuff recently with Burmese pythons in the Everglades where when people relocated them, they just went straight back to where they were caught.
Yeah, that's an issue. So you've observed, you've obviously spent a lot of time with the water pythons and other liasses in the wild. Can you give us a little bit of their natural history and what you've observed with them in the wild, like temperature-wise, what you've seen them, normal prey items and things like that, but what you've seen that might benefit someone trying to keep them in captivity?
Yeah, sure. Water pythons are, you know, they're quite common across a large area in tropical Australia, but the abundance is, or at least was, phenomenal at this one place, Fog Dam. It was very famous as the place to see water pythons. The dam walls are sort of a bit less than 2 kilometres long, and you could go backwards and forwards at night and see a lot of water pythons. I think our record was something like 50 pythons just going back once and twice. they were nothing like as common in other places. The other places we looked at them, they had pretty diverse diets. You know, they ate a bit of everything, mammals, birds, the occasional reptile. But at Fog Dam, where we've done almost all of our work, there's a native rat called the dusky rat that's very common, and that was 95% of the water python's diet. And the pythons would mostly get adult male rats because they would get pushed out by fighting with other male rats, and they'd end up sort of on the edges of the dam, which is where the pythons would find them. And in most years, the pythons would eat dusky rats and almost nothing else. In years when the rats were in plague numbers, then the feeding rate was huge. I mean, I'm not much of a snake keeper in captivity. I've kept plenty over the years. I've never been particularly good at it. But I'd always, you know, worried about feeding snakes too much and so on. When those rat plagues were on, the water pythons were just full of rats. You know, there'd be half a dozen rats inside every python. They were growing at rates I wouldn't have believed. They were fatter than any captive snake I'd ever seen. So it's a feast and famine system where, under the right conditions, I think the snakes get a vast amount of food and they can deal with it. There are some interesting little patterns so that, for example, year-to-year variation in rainfall determines the number of rats. If it stays wet into the dry season, the rats can breed for longer and there's a lot more of them. And so in those years, the water pythons have a lot more food, they're in much better condition, they grow faster, the females, higher proportion of females reproduce, and so on. And in years that have that are dry at that time of year, the rats don't get a chance to breed for as long, there's fewer rats, the baby pythons tend not to survive, the adults grow slowly, a lot of the females don't reproduce. There's a cute pattern where the big problem for a baby water python is that it's not big enough to eat an adult rat. It needs to eat young rats. And so if the rats stop breeding before the baby pythons hatch out of their eggs, they're in big trouble. And the pythons will starve even though there are plenty of adult rats around. So the timing's important. One of the things that we discovered, and again, Thomas Madsen's the guy that deserves the credit, is that the growth rate of a python is set by the amount of food that it encounters when it's very young. So as you'd expect, pythons grow faster in years when there's more rats around. But a python that hatched out in a year when there were lots of rats around seems to put a lot of its energy into growth. It kind of seems to know that life is good, it lives in a good place, it can afford to grow, it doesn't have to put a lot of energy into storage and fat bodies, it's not going to hit bad times. And so those guys keep growing even when there's not too many rats around, whereas the young pythons that hatch out in years when there were very few rats, they play a very conservative strategy. They put most of their energy into fat bodies and so on, and they only grow quite slowly. So the growth rate of a snake is determined not just by how much food is around now, but by how much food it encountered when it was younger. And I guess there's a message in there for pet keepers as well. One of the amazing things that's happened at Frog Dam, and it's pretty tragic, is that in 2005, there was very heavy rainfall just upstream of our study area. And this is it's just an extreme weather event. It's the kind of thing that every climate model tells us is going to become more common with climate change, and certainly seems to be happening here in Australia. Anyway, that very heavy rainfall event, about 50 kilometres away from our study site, sent this sort of inland tsunami down the Adelaide River, and it flooded the floodplain below Fog Dam, and it drowned all the rats. And so suddenly there was no food for the pythons. And you might have thought that they would wander off and go up to the nearby hills where there were still rats, but they didn't. They waited for the rats to come back, and the rats didn't come back, and the pythons starved to death. So we probably had something like 80% mortality of water pythons in this site. So for 20-odd years, the numbers have been very stable, very high, have been affected by wet season rainfall, but suddenly one day's rainfall, 50 kilometres away, made that system crash. And it was just starting to recover when we had a cyclone came through, and it filled the floodplain again, and it killed the rats again, and so it's knocked them back again. I was up there a couple of weeks ago, and there's just a few skinny pythons most of which probably aren't going to make it, crawling around the damn wall. So it is pretty tragic that, just a very short extreme weather event can totally destroy the prey base for these animals. The pythons do what they can. They're eating frill neck lizards and goannas and snakes, but there's just not much food for them. And so it really is a very sensitive system.
Huh. Wow. I have a real quick question about the you were talking about the pythons that are able to when they're young and they're putting their food towards growing. Were you able to see any correlation between those animals and when they became adults and maybe the success that they had as breeders?
No, we don't really have the data. My guess is that it depends on what kind of a world you're living in. I think that the strategy of growing fast and just going for it probably works fine as long as conditions are good. And those animals probably would do very well if we kept getting good wet seasons. But when the bad times come, I think we've got several studies now. We've done it with file snakes with red-bellied black snakes and with the water pythons. When the bad times come, the ones that die first are the big guys because they've got larger maintenance costs probably. They can't fit down the burrows to get at the rats as easily. And so what happened when that big crash came was that we got a few very slow-growing females that matured at small body sizes and had small clutches of eggs, and they seem to be the only success stories. So, look, I think when times go bad, you've got to take a conservative view. You guys might know more about the stock market than I do, but perhaps that's the same strategy that water pythons are using.
Nice.
Yeah, we don't know anything about the stock market.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. So back when you had those plague numbers of rats, did you just see the numbers of pythons in general across the board, or even just snakes across the board? Did you see them just doing increase to astronomical numbers, I assume, correct?
Yeah, there's a bit of a lag time. You know, it takes them a while. And I think one of the things that happens is that I know when I was younger and there were mouse plagues out in the desert areas. I thought, wow, this will be fantastic. You know, the mice will be everywhere. There'll be snakes feeding on them. It'll be a fantastic place to go. And, in fact, I couldn't find any snakes because they were all full of mice and were just sitting somewhere in a hole, probably wishing they hadn't eaten quite so many because they had stomach aches. But they were breeding, you know, for months, and there were plenty of snakes there, but you didn't see them much. Now, look, the numbers come and go. The really strange thing that's happened at Fog Dam is that we've had the arrival of the cane toad, this very poisonous South American frog, which, you know, we were very worried about, and it was clear from the laboratory work that a lot of the snakes would try to eat them and would die. But what's happened is that, in fact, the snakes have become more common at Fog Dam because the pythons have killed all the big monitor lizards that used to be major predators on snakes. So things like death adders that we thought would be in desperate trouble are actually becoming more common. And one of the snakes that we now see quite frequently that used to be, you know, as rare as rocking horse droppings, it used to be a big deal to see a black-headed python, Aspidites melanocephalus. It's really kind of on the edge of the suitable habitat for them. We actually see black-headed pythons now quite frequently. And I think it's somehow or other related to the fact that the cane toads have killed the monitor lizards. So you get winners and losers in these things, and species that you don't see around for a decade or two are suddenly a common sight, and vice versa.
Interesting. Now, I have a question that was sent to us by Richard A. Simmons, and it's about the breeding of diamond pythons. He wants to know if you've noticed in your research any correlation between multiple copulations and the ability to reproduce in diamond pythons that you may have seen in Swedish adders as well?
Mm. Yeah, we did, again, this same guy, Thomas Madsen, who's a Swede by birth, did some beautiful work with hatters in southern Sweden, and it was a very small, isolated population, very inbred. A very high proportion of the babies were stillborn and were deformed. And by bringing in a few extra males from another population, we completely eliminated the incidence of stillbirths. So it was a clear case where, and the females that mated with lots of boys had much healthier babies than the females that only mated with one boy. The genetic diversity in the sperm was critical. Now, certainly the diamonds, the females, as with most snakes, the females are very happy to mate with more than one male. The strange thing about the diamonds is that the boys just ignore each other. So you'll get a group of half a dozen boys with a girl, and they just seem to take turns. Whereas carpet snakes that are very closely related and only a few hundred kilometres away, the boys beat each other up and they very vigorously attack other males. Carpet pythons in Western Australia are like diamond pythons. The mating system is very different in different populations. But we don't actually have any data from the field as to how many boys a girl would mate with and what that does for the kids. I'm afraid I basically don't know the answer, but I would have thought that if you get an inbred population, and that kind of thing becomes very important. If you have a large outbred population, most of the girls are probably finding enough boyfriends that it's not a big deal. In captivity, yeah, I would have thought it's probably not a bad idea to let the girl have an opportunity for a rich and varied social life, a few more healthy offspring.
Now, would you assume that this would also happen with, I know there's some species that are just so... I guess either hard to find or their range is so small, with rough scale pythons and Owen belly pythons, that do you think that they're having enough of a genetic diversity to avoid some of these issues, or do you feel that the wild population eventually is going to hit something like that event in the future where they're going to have some issues with that?
I'm really not sure. I know with Owen Pellies, I've seen photographs of groups of males with females, so I'm sure that multiple mating is common there.
Mm-hmm.
With rough scales, we have very little in the way of field information, really. The adders that Thomas worked on in Sweden in Smegahook was a very small population. In some years there were only one or two females reproductive and, you know, a dozen males roaring around. In other years there were a dozen females, but it was a very small population. It had been cut off probably for 100 years by agricultural activity. So it was an extreme. Whether or not these sort of genetic problems are a big deal for animals in the wild, it's a little hard to know. I suspect that they are, but how important they are, I'm afraid we just don't have the information.
Okay. Awesome.
Interesting. I know you've done quite a few papers on Morelia imbricata. I was just curious because we don't really have that many people that can come on and talk about them. I was wondering if you could, you know, maybe just same thing that you did for the water pythons, if you could talk a bit about some of your research with them.
Sure. Well, the hero with the imbricata is a guy called David Pearson, who's a research officer with a state government organisation over in Western Australia, a wildlife department. And so David did his PhD on the pythons. And again, a bit like the diamonds, there was a feeling that perhaps they were in trouble from over-collection for the pet trade. They're an attractive snake. They're a very mellow snake like the diamonds, unlike the coastal carpets. And nobody really knew how many of them there were or what they were doing. So David did a big radio transmitter-based study, got a huge number of animals in the end. It turned out that they were hanging on very well in most parts of that range in southwestern Australia. As with diamond pythons, males are smaller than females, and you get groups of males together with a girl, and they don't fight each other, whereas with carpets... coastal carpets and the tropical carpets, the males are much bigger than females and they beat each other up. Probably the most interesting story I think that we got out of the imbricata was that they occur on a variety of small islands off southwestern Australia. And those different islands have got different prey resources. And so perhaps the most dramatic example was a place called Garden Island, which is not very far from Perth. There's a naval facility there. It's a small island. And there's only two species of mammals that occur on Garden Island. And one of them is a small kangaroo, a wallaby, and the other one is the house mouse. And this makes it very difficult if you're a young python. There's plenty of mice, so that you grow up, you start eating mice, that's fine. But you get to about a metre long, and a mouse really isn't a satisfying meal. You really want to eat something bigger, but the next smallest thing you can find is a baby wallaby, and that's pretty big. And so you get a lot of very thin snakes desperately trying to grow past that kind of window in body sizes where there's no suitable size prey item. And what happens is that some of the females manage to get through that window. Once you get big enough and you can start eating wallabies, then there's lots of food. And so the females are huge animals, weigh many kilos. But the males never get past that window. So the males are all tiny. So you get this remarkably extreme sexual difference in size, where all the boys are little pygmies and all the girls are these huge giants, or the adult girls. But you go to other islands where there's a wider range of medium-sized mammals, and the males get almost as big as the females. They're not quite as big, but if there's no wallabies around, the females don't get particularly large either, so that you actually get a much more sort of a sensible-looking system, much more like diamond pythons, where the females average, 10%, 15% larger than the boys. So that the degree of sex difference in body size is entirely driven by the range of mammal sizes that are out there. And if you live in a world where there's only really big ones and really small ones, then you're either a really big snake or a really small snake.
Wow, that's pretty interesting. Now, I've often heard it said that typically when you have a male python that's smaller, especially with carpets, you're not seeing combat involved in the mating ritual. Have you observed the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, the general pattern, we're going back here to the 1970s. One of the first papers I ever wrote was I noticed that this correlation, that the snake species where males beat each other up with combat, males frequently grow larger than females, whereas in the species where females grow larger than males, the males often just ignore each other. It's not true 100% of the time. In things like adders, the males are smaller, but they fight a lot and so on, but it's a very strong general pattern. And it applies even within the carpet snake group, so that with subspecies like the diamond python and imbricata, the males are much smaller than females, and we don't see any sign of the boys fighting, whereas as soon as we head up into the other carpet python groups, then we get males much larger than females, and they engage in these very vigorous battles. Having said that, I've seen a couple of diamond pythons that I've come across in the bush near Sydney that have got scars on them that look very much to me like the sort of scars you get when the males fight. And Mark Fitzgerald, working on carpet pythons up in coastal New South Wales, where the boys are bigger than the girls and the boys fight each other and so on, did find one group of three or four males with a female, all apparently ignoring each other and doing just what diamond pythons do. So it's probably a lot more complicated than we think. But I think in general, the populations where the boys are very small and the girls are very big, you're likely to have all peace and love. And the cases where the boys are bigger than the girls, in every case I know, the big fellas try to beat each other up to get access to the girls.
Okay. I have a question as far as what are your thoughts on the whole intergrade zone between like the coastal carpet and the diamond python?
I occasionally thought it would be a lot of fun to try and look at that in real detail. I mean, all I really know is that if you drive north from Sydney, you don't go very far before you see things that I would call classical carpet pythons. And it's quite a steep intergrade zone, I think. It'd be nice to know what happens where you get essentially the genes from both kinds of animals mixing. You have boys playing each of those tactics. clearly what's happened is that we've had sort of a contraction of the range of these things during climatic extremes where we've almost gone to having a separate species. They've been separate for so long down in the Sydney Basin, but then as the climate has changed again, they've expanded out and they've contacted each other. So they're very different kinds of animals in lots of ways, but they're interfertile. And of course, most of the Australian pythons can interbreed genetically quite easily. They tend not to do so in the wild. And that hybrid zone seems to be surprisingly narrow. Perhaps it's quite a recent contact zone.
Okay. All right. There's a couple more questions that we have. I don't know if you're good on time. Are you still okay for time?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Awesome.
Can you talk a little bit about the evolutionary history and the diversification of pythons in Australia?
Not with any great confidence. There's always been two competing ideas about the history of pythons in Australia, and I thought they would have been resolved a long time ago, but when I get the molecular genetics guys up against the wall and shine a light in their eyes and ask them what the answer is, they get all difficult and they wiggle a bit. I think the likely story is that pythons evolved, through Africa, Asia. They came down to Australia and they've diversified within Australia. But there is an alternative hypothesis that they actually evolved within Australia, and that the ones without labial pits, the black-headed pythons, the wombat python, are close to the ancestral python, and that they then went off from there and colonized Asia. And I still don't know which of those is true. I think the former of them is more likely, and that the wombat and the blackhead are a secondary movement back into a less python-like lifestyle. Most of our pythons are clearly been around for a long time. A lot of local divergence in colours and probably in ecology and mating systems. Things like Breedel's python sitting out there in Alice Springs, more or less separated from most of the rest of the carpets by a lot of very dry country that's not suitable right now. We see the same thing with some of the other groups of snakes. So look, it's an ancient radiation with a very substantial diversity. We still don't know very much about the basic biology of most of those species. Things like children's pythons that are very popular pets, nobody has yet done a convincing ecological study of the children's python in the wild, even though there are plenty of them out there and it wouldn't be hard to do. It's only very recently that the wombat python has been done. So we still have a lot of gaps in our knowledge. And as far as the evolutionary history, I think we still have to wait a little while before the geneticists are completely confident.
Wow. Okay. So I guess would be we'd start with the children's python. You'd have to start with, like, field studies and observations in the wild, correct? You wouldn't just jump into observing the captive population.
Yeah, I think you can learn an enormous amount from the captive animals. And people like Dale Donato in Arizona and his group have done a lot of beautiful work looking at maternal brooding behavior in children's pythons and so on. They're a lovely model to look at pythons because they're small enough and easy enough to keep. You know, if you tried to do it with reticulated pythons, you'd need a very large animal house.
Well, the other thing I wanted to ask you about is the research being done on some of the invasive species. I mean, you mentioned the cane toad and the impact that they had on the population of reptiles and how some fared better than others. I know that there are other introduced species out there that are kind of running amok. Have you seen a pretty bad down curve in some of the other reptiles due to the other invasive species, like cats, foxes, a few other things that will run around out there.
Yeah, Australia's got a terrible history with invasive species. You know, we were isolated through evolutionary time, and so we don't have things like cats and foxes and cane toads. And so there are lots of potential invaders that can get here and cause problems. I think cats and foxes have been absolutely devastating. One of the things that struck me when Mark Fitzgerald was working on the coastal carpet snakes, which, you know, these are big snakes and they have attitude. And, you know, frankly, I think twice before jumping in there and trying to catch a big male carpet. But whenever these guys would leave the safety of these very thickly forested gullies where they spent most of their time in the macadamia orchards, if they moved across open country, they were quite likely to be killed by probably foxes, maybe dogs, but we think probably foxes. And you go out to locate them and you just find a transmitter chewed up. So I would have thought that one of those snakes probably could eat a fox pretty easily, but clearly the foxes are smart and agile. And so I think that, you know, there's no doubt that invasive species are a huge problem. And of course, we've added to that, we've got a lot of other environmental problems in Australia over large areas of agriculture. The natural habitat's been pretty much destroyed. And fire is a big issue. Taking water out of the inland rivers and giving it to the farmers for irrigation has created terrible troubles. You know, I think on the one hand, there are lots of catastrophe stories. On the other hand, if you'd asked me, would there be large pythons living in the ceilings of people's homes in every major capital city in mainland Australia, I would have thought that was unlikely, but it's the case. Morelia is amazing. Up in Queensland, it's scrub pythons, especially Amethystina and Kinghorn eye. In most of the rest of the country, it's a Spilota of some kind or other, but they do incredibly well in disturbed habitats. They hang on, they exploit the extra availability of things like birds and possums and maybe the odd stray dog. And so really, pythons haven't done too badly overall compared to many of the other groups of animals in Australia.
So with interactions with the kinghorn eye, I know you said you didn't want to, you think twice about diving into a gully with an adult male carpet, which it dive anywhere with a big kinghorn eye. I mean, I've never actually seen one, but I have been told that they are 18 feet of unhappy. So,
yeah, I've had very little experience with them. I've found a few, and I've seen one good bite that looked like it would have been fairly unpleasant. I'm very pleased it wasn't me that was the recipient. Dan Natush is currently doing his PhD on the scrub pythons up in the tip of Cape York, and up there they're actually fairly friendly souls and pretty easy to handle. But I think some of the big blokes down around Cairns and so forth would indeed be a hell of a handful to try to play with.
Yeah.
Wow. What kind of research has been done as far as trying to stop the cane toad from spreading across Australia?
That's a whole other hour of interviews, I think. That's my biggest current research project. We've been working on the cane toads now for a decade, and we're doing all kinds of things. Measuring their impact, looking at their biology, and working out ways to control them. And we've got a bunch of very encouraging results in terms of using chemicals that toad tadpoles produce that we can use to trap them from water bodies and to kill them, even if we can't get our hands on the little darling. So the toads are spreading rapidly. They're now spreading through Western Australia, through the Kimberley, getting towards the rough-scale python habitat. But I think at the same time we're starting to get some weapons against them that probably will be much more effective than anything we've had before.
So you said that right now you're attempting to wipe out the cane toad when they are in their tadpole stage?
Yeah. Basically, people have gone out, community groups especially, and they've picked up huge numbers of adult toads, But a single female toad can have 30,000 eggs. So you're wasting your time just going out picking up adults, because you've only got to miss one or two, and you always will, and they can replace their numbers quicker than you can get rid of them. But if you can stop them from breeding, then you can go out there and pick them up and get rid of them. So we've focused our effort on how you stop toads from breeding, and it's looking encouraging. We're not there yet, but it's looking a lot better than it did 5 years ago.
Wow. I know that's been a big problem is the cane toad, so any progress in the right direction is good, very, very good. So hopefully they can get beat back to a non-issue. That's awesome.
Well, I hope so too.
The other invasives, like is there, I know you can't really stop cats from breeding by putting a chemical in the water, but is there anything else with those projects that you're aware of attempting to knock them back?
I know that there's been a lot of work on specific poisons to kill cats, for example, but there's concern about whether or not those poisons will also kill the big monitor lizards, things like that.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of campaigns. There's a lot of cats and foxes are being killed in various ways, but they are very, very difficult creatures to deal with. But I fear you probably have to talk to somebody else to get the lowdown on that. So I'm going to have to go, I'm afraid, gentlemen. I've got a meeting that I have to run off to, but it's been very enjoyable to talk to you guys.
Absolutely.
Thank you
so much.
Pleasure.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. See you, Richard. Well, there we go. A very cool, very cool interview. I think when we go down through all... What?
Good. Well, I hope they are able to knock down the cane toad population, because I know it's been something that, you know, ever since I was a kid watching specials on how these things are just decimating anything that tries to eat them. I think there's only one snake in the whole of Australia that can take the toxin and eat these things. Everything else that tries to eat it just dies, and it's a big issue. But I also understand that the cats are even worse, because they'll not only kill the reptiles, they'll kill the mammals and everything else under the sun. So it's good that they're able to do that, and I'm glad he's like get the tadpoles. You know, that's the issue. If you can get in one day, you can wipe out like 60,000 tadpoles. It's better than running around and catching 100. So good.
Yeah. So yeah, that was a I knew he was pressed against time. You know, because of course. Over there, it's daytime, and he has a job and whatnot. But leaves more time to come back for another.
Exactly, and the fact that he even took the time to talk to us in general is very awesome of him. I mean, he's got research projects and classes to teach and all this other stuff, so he's probably running around all over the place. But it was very cool. And what were you saying about when we go to Australia? Can we do that? When is that happening, and what are we doing? What were you going to say?
Oh, that we have to have a beer with them.
Yes. I completely agree. We'll show up, and we'll say that all Australian people meet here for beer. So.
No, I just, you know, like when you're sitting down and you're talking to somebody like that, he's like, I guess he's just very, he has a voice that's very... So somebody you could just listen to for a long time speak about, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, he's very receptive. I thought that maybe, you know, he would be difficult to talk to simply because of how smart he is and all the research that he's done. But, you know what I'm saying? Like, he puts it in layman's terms, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. But very cool. Very, very cool. But, yeah, absolutely. We'll be having him back on for sure. But cool stuff. I know that I don't know exactly where it's at on Herp Nation's website, but I know he did a show, and it was actually pretty fascinating, where he talked to them about that same thing about his cane toad research, and he went into a little more detail about it, and it was quite fascinating. So I guess if you have a chance and you can track that down, you should definitely try to listen to that for sure.
Yeah. That would be interesting to listen to his whole cane toad research and see what they're doing there, as well as everything else. I mean, we didn't get to ask him, like, what's the next python research that you're going to do? I know he said something about children's python, but would you move into something else? All that stuff. So it's like we got to have him back on at some point. Or, hell, we'll just go to Australia with microphones. Get on the plane.
Yeah.
Eric, get a plane.
Yeah, so. I'll work on that. But, I guess, are we live anymore? I don't know. I'm not by my computer. I kept getting Facebook message and I wasn't concentrating, so I had to walk away.
we don't want to talk to you people right now, okay? Or Eric doesn't want to talk to you. I still love you.
It's, you know, when you're talking to a guest like that, you want to concentrate on what's going on. But awesome stuff.
You can't sound like assholes. Yeah.
Of course, you go. You're ranting and raving about taxonomy before we.
Well, that was bad. Whoa!
Blow the boat.
That was before he got on, sir.
Oh, okay.
And
gotcha.
After, I'm allowed to act like a jackass before and after the guests are on, unless it's the guest that's been on before. Then I can just act like a jackass throughout. So,
oh, okay, gotcha.
Yeah. Come on.
All right, so let's run this baby down and we'll call it.
Peace.
I'm not sure who's coming on next week, but we got a couple cool guests lined up.
It's a mystery.
Back. Some confirmation of what's going to be next week and for the month of June. I think it's time that maybe we revisit some of our earlier guests that we've had on way back in the early days of Morelia Python Radio. And
when we
be
sucked.
Yeah. What do you mean, when? No, I'm just kidding. But we're coming up on this will be 3 years.
Oh my god! No, that's in October, isn't it?
Yeah, 3 years. Yeah.
3 years, Jesus Christ!
Goes quick. I know. So for 3 years, Tuesday.
Why are you people still listening? Jesus Christ!
Oh man!
What more do we have to do?
Yeah, right. So let's see. Let's give a shout out real quick for our good buddy Chris Behoff, CB Reptiles. He has a thing going on right now. He has a discount that CB Reptiles is offering up with Ship Your Reptiles, and it's 40% off your shipping retail rates through Ship Your Reptiles. And the coupon code is CBR40. You can use that. It's a one-time coupon, and you're good to go. And that's brought to you by, like I said, Chris Behoff of CB Reptiles and Ship Your Reptiles. You can go over and check out Ship Your Reptiles at www.shipyourreptiles.com. If you are looking for a carpet python and you're cruising around on Facebook and you're in the United States, go and check
if
out.
If you've met all that criteria, go here.
You can check out the Carpet Python Classified on Facebook. There's actually two of them. There's one that's over in Europe, which our buddy Casper runs, and then there's the one over here in the U.S., which Chris runs. So a lot of cool stuff. Chris goes through and makes sure that there's no knucklehead nonsense going on, and he polices it pretty good. So you can rest assured that if you're looking for a carpet python, that that should be one of your spots to check out. So that's that. Don't forget to check out the forum, www.moreliapythons.com, and do your research over there as far as all your Morelia questions, pretty much everything that you would need to know is kind of over there. So by all means, go and check it out. For us, MoreliaPythonRadio.com, did a little tweaking over there to the site. Still doing some tweaking, but added up some cool pictures of you know how I have the whole morphs of the Morelia complex thing going on, and then there's also the Morelia complex. So, you know, if you're curious about what's what is, you know, how does the subspecies break down, what's going on in the Morelia complex, yeah, you go over there, check out those pages, and you'll be able to maybe get a better understanding of what's going on. And, of course, all the breeders that and keepers that contributed pictures, their links are all there. You know, the thing I don't really talk about, but past guests, links are on there. So if you listen to a show and you really like what the
quiet dog, don't you see we're doing the show?
Damn it! Got attacked.
Yeah, kick him. Jesus.
If you, I'm gonna have to walk in the other room now.
Dexter, get Dexter. No, down Dexter. Bad. Did it work?
Damn little dogs. Anyway.
that was counterproductive.
Yeah. Notice at the beginning of the show, Heather's dog was like, roo, 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 roo.
Well, actually, Heather just messaged me. She goes, now to see whose dog's eating someone. So it wasn't the Malinois. It was the dachshund that we had to watch out for. And I apologize for the Malinois enthusiasts out there. So.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. So
anyway,
go over, check out, MoreliaPythonRadio.com. It's pretty much, we try to make it the hub for all your Morelia wants and needs, questions, whatever. If you have a question or a comment for us, by all means, send it to us at info@MoreliaPythonRadio.com. Don't forget about the Carpet Fest Northwest edition, July 26th. If you want to go over and check out the Facebook page that Heather has up, it's I believe it's called Northwest Carpet Fest, and you can get all your information there. And what else do we have? I'm trying to think. I feel like I'm forgetting something. Oh, don't forget Mr. Nick Mutton's clutch data that he's looking for.
Yes.
You're in the middle of we're in the middle of hatching season. If you want to take part in that, you can go over to Morelia Pick of the Week. It's up on MoreliaPythonRadio.com. I think it's on our Morelia Python Radio Facebook page. But you can download that there, fill it out, send it to Nick via email. And it will be much appreciated, and it would be cool that you'd be able to partake in the research that he's doing. And the research has to do with twins and carpet pythons. His goal is to write a paper, and by goodness, if you want to try to help him out, by all means, there's your way to do it. As far as me. We were talking earlier. Looks like Tinley Park is a go for me. So I'll be out there. And I think you said you're rearranging something and you'll be out there.
The big problem is that I can't really rearrange the thing that could be preventing me because it's my mother's wedding. So I have no say in this matter.
Yeah.
And I'm her, you know, eldest son, I'm going to be the one who has to walk her down the aisle, so I can't really skip. So the plan is that I will make it to Tinley if I have to show up in a tuxedo on Saturday morning, having freshly got off a plane. So we're going to do this. I just might be the best dressed motherfucker there. So there we go. It'll be cool. Oh, God. You're still there. Where'd you go? Stop going places.
No. Oh.
Close out the show, damn it.
Okay, I do have one more thing to throw out there. Hold on. Oh, my goodness.
No. Beat the dog later.
Damn dogs. Thank God it's when Richard wasn't on. He'd be so embarrassed. Like, oh, my God. Thank God it's overtime. I'm sorry, everybody.
You're pausing the show to go deal with your unruly herd of dachshunds. You realize this, right?
Yeah, right. Oh, man.
Yeah, okay. Anyway.
We're giving a shout out for US ARC and RAACA raffle. Let's see. It's I guess they're doing a raffle for U.S. ARC again, and you know Jordan Russell, he's the guy that is one of in charge of these things. But by all means, go over and check it out at www.raaca.net, and then it's a backslash. But I'll throw the link over on the Morelia Python radio page. We're always trying to support those guys in any way we can.
And it's some good stuff in that auction that they usually do. It's some pretty amazing things. And what I like about it is that if you back out after winning, they will publicly chastise you like there is no tomorrow. So if you bid, you better be married to that bid, because if you back out, you're done. They will. Oh, so. But great work that they do, and they've raised a lot of money so far. And like I said, it's great auction items over there. They get some good stuff. Given from a lot of people. So if you're not a fan of that Facebook group yet, you're missing out. So go jump on that. We'll wait.
I just posted it up, so you have no excuse now. But, yep, absolutely.
Exactly, so now it's over, yeah.
And so Tinley Park is going to be cool. I know it's a ways away, but I just wanted
stuff
to let
to
everyone
think about people.
Yeah, so it should be
yeah.
cool. I know a couple people from Australia contacted me, and they're going to be coming up, so I'm looking forward to meeting them finally.
Yeah.
And our big announcement that's coming up, that'll tie into that, too. So,
huge announcement.
Yeah,
Eric
huge.
And I going to the moon. No, sorry, that was a different one.
Yeah, that was something else.
And
next Saturday, I will be at Hamburg with
Owen, right.
celebrating his birthday.
Yeah,
so.
If I'm sober by noon, I've done something wrong, right? So.
I'm there to sell all of his snakes at half price.
Yeah, here's the thing. I'm going to sit down because every time I go, I end up selling all your shit. So I'm going to sit down because then you can do it and you'll sell all my shit. So, yeah.
See how that'll work?
Role reversal. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I don't know. I'll take anything at this point. So,
so we'll be up there. I guess I don't really have anything available yet, but I may put a couple things up, some older carpet pythons that thinning out the herd and such. So look for that, and I can drop it off at Hamburg if you're interested. So be paying attention, and who knows? Maybe he'll get something cool. Otherwise, I will sell Owen's animals at the show. While Owen's
damn
is
right.
back and drinks his beer.
Yeah.
And he will be the one he will be the one that's drunk this time, not me. Anyway, the last thing I have for us, actually, is but if you don't get to listen to the show live, go over to iTunes, and you can download it for free. Get it right to your iPod or iPhone or whatever you so choose. But you go check it out. You can get it there. And that's all I have, Owen.
All right. What we got is go to rogue-reptile.com. Check out Rogue. Their latest happenings, new pictures, projects we're working on, also little hints to things that we're getting into, because I'll start updating stuff before I tell you people about it. So information's right there. Also, you can go to iHerb and look up Rogue Reptiles. We're on there, too. breakdowns of all our animals. Also, you can go onto the Facebook page and just find Rogue. Like I said, if you are a fan of the Facebook page, you get to see what we put up for sale before I send it out to the other places like King Snake Fauna and the Reptile Report Classifieds. Kind of like a little peek for everybody who's a fan of Rogue. Right now, Super Carnival Jacks are going to be up and running. We got other clutches cooking, and I'm waiting on a few females to drop still. So if you want to be on some of our lists, let us know. If you are one of the people that was waiting on blackface, white-lipped pythons, I'm sorry we didn't get any this year. Stop emailing me, okay?
You suck. You suck.
I know.
Ah.
I'm sorry.
I was finally going to get into the white-lipped pythons, and you just ruined it for me.
I'll get it next year, all right?
My God.
Yeah. And you ain't buying white lips yet. Don't you start with me. So,
well, maybe I'll have to go. No.
I'll break your legs. So, you and I got to talk about this later. Anyway.
Carry on.
Hopefully everybody can come out to Hamburg next Saturday the 14th. Like I said, it is my birthday. I would love to see as many people as I can, Morelia enthusiasts, on my birthday to talk up Morelia. It would be a great way to kind of celebrate it. And then, hell, if you're going to be in the area, I'll tell you what bar we're meeting up at, and we're all going to get hammered later, so it'll be cool. All right, on that note, what I'll say is thank you, everybody, for listening, and we will see you all next week for some more Morelia Python Radio. Good night.
Is that any